Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 95 for November 12th, 2009. The Open Rights Group. Floss Weekly is brought to you by the new Ford Sync featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation. All voice-activated from Ford Sync. For more details and to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the show all about free Libra and open source software. It's Jeff's fault. If Jeff hadn't done such a great theme for us, I wouldn't be moved to sing every time I hear it. Hello, Randall Schwartz.
Hey, Leo. Good to see you again. Good to talk with you again. It's always a fun thing when I finally get to come back on the show and not tied up with clients on site. So that's always fun.
We have a serious topic today.
We do, but before we get to that, I have to put a plug in. I'm so excited, so excited. Yes, yes, I was nominated. Floss Weekly was nominated for the Podcast Awards. That is so cool.
Congratulations, in the technology group against Security Now. I'm going to let you two fight it out.
It's really okay with me if I don't win. I mean, and also Callie Lewis, too. It's hard to beat Callie Lewis.
There's a lot of great stuff. I mean, don't say that now. We can beat Callie Lewis. We can beat anybody. All we have to do is have our viewers vote.
Yes, I would encourage you to go to podcastawards.com. You have between November 13th and November 30th to make the votes. And it would thrill me to death if I won. And it's also okay if I don't, because I'm up against some very good competition. So, but please,
Are you saying it's okay just to be nominated? I'm excited to be nominated.
I am happy to be nominated. So that is, I'm already thrilled. So that's really good. But if you happen to go to podcastawards.com and go down to the technology section, we're in the technology section there, sometime between November 13th and November 30th, I would really appreciate it.
Podcastawards.com. Don't let this geek cry home tonight. He's so sad. Yes. So sad. Hey, we are blessed with two very, very good guests. Jim Killock is with... EFF. I'm sorry, he's with the Open Rights Group, isn't he? ORG, OpenRightsGroup.org. Mm-hmm.
Right, in the UK, yes.
And Danny O'Brien, who is with EFF and helped start ORG. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about this is not open source, but some very important issues for everybody who cares about a free and open internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you what, I want to get him on in a second. Before I do, can I mention do you know we have a sponsor, Mr. Randall Schwartz?
Sponsor! Yay!
And it's not just any sponsor.
I can eat lunch finally.
It's not just any sponsor. It's Ford Sync. I can finally reveal that I did indeed purchase a Ford automobile last week. I went in to look at the Ford Sync technology and fell in love with a Mustang. It had my name on it. It was calling to me. Leo, it said, touch my bucket seats. Leo, I'm bright red. Leo, look at this amazing hands-free Bluetooth music search turn-by-turn navigation system installed in me. Oh, I got in, and yeah, I went home with a Mustang, but I also went home with Ford Sync, which is amazing. Look, nowadays, in many states, you're not allowed to hold the phone. You're not allowed to text. And even if you were... could you please not do that? It's dangerous. That's why something like Sync, it makes you safer while you're driving. You never take your hands off the wheel. The Sync buttons are right on the wheel. Its voice recognition is amazing. So you talk to Sync and ask it what you want. Sync's amazing. You could say things like, of course, obvious, call Jennifer at home when I want to call my wife. Call Randall on his mobile. I can say also things, though, like play Floss Weekly. Yeah, when I connect my iPhone, it has a USB jack, an audio jack, and it has Bluetooth. So I connect the iPhone in any, or iPod, or Zune, or any of the USB or audio devices you have can be connected in any of those three ways. When you connect it via USB, it scans through, it indexes everything, puts it up, in its memory, so it knows what you have on there, and you can ask for a song by name. You can whether it's a Zune or an iPod, even if it's a USB key with songs on it, as long as they have tags on it, you can ask for it by name. Just mind-boggling. Play Floss Weekly, and it plays. You could say, play the New York Times front page. It'll read it to you. You can, if you have the right kind of phone, if an inbound text message, it will read it to you, and you can send a message back. You could say, text, be there in 10 minutes, and it will send it out. Play artist, play genre, play podcast, play next track, play similar. The voice recognition is superb. And now here's a cool thing. Now, I have a GPS screen in my car, but if you don't have to get the GPS screen. I know that costs a lot of money, or buy a third-party GPS. Ford Sync, you can talk to and tell it, take me home, and it will tell you turn-by-turn directions. It will tell you the traffic on the way. It will tell you alternate routes. It'll tell you the weather, where you're going. Give you sports scores and more. I'm telling you, Ford Sync is truly amazing technology. Next time you are at a Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury dealer, I want you to stop by and take a look at the Ford Sync. And can I ask you to help us out by tweeting? You'll help yourself out, too, because it's a chance for you to win a free Nano or free Zune. You can either go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com to find out more about it. They've got 15 free Nanos and 15 free Zunes they're giving away through December 8th. Or merely tweet, say, I was listening to Floss Weekly and I heard all about the Ford Sync. And use a tag, the hashtag pound sync my ride podcast, all one word, pound SYNCMYRIDE podcast, and you'll be automatically entered to win. They're giving one away every day, 15 free Nanos, 15 free Zunes. All you got to do is tweet sync my ride podcast, use a pound sign right before that, make it a hashtag, or visit syncmyridepodcast.com for more information. We thank them. We thank Ford so much for making it possible for Randall Schwartz to have lunch. Thank you. Thank you, Ford. All right, let's get our guys on because this is such an interesting conversation. So, Randall, I think we have our guests in here. Danny O'Brien from the EFF in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us, Danny.
Thank you.
And from Great Britain, we've got Jim Killock, who is with the Open Rights Group. Hey, Jim.
Hiya. How you doing?
You forgive the noise. It's a Veterans Day in the States, and the big Veterans Day parade is going right by my window.
As long as the train doesn't come right through the
office. Sounds like a train, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. It
sounds a little bit like that, yes. Yeah.
So, this is a good time to be talking to you two, I tell you. What a mess we have with our copyright laws these days.
Bye.
Yep.
What is Open Rights Group? Maybe we should start off by talking about that, Jim.
Good point.
Yeah, well, we was formed about 4 years ago. Nearly exactly 4 years ago, by about 1,000 digital rights activists who wanted to see something in the UK rather like the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the States that would stand up for user rights in copyright, for our privacy rights, and against things like digital rights management and other unnecessary and unfair restrictions on consumers, if you like, or users, if you want to use slightly more modern language. So that's what happened. And we've been working on copyright term extension, stopping plans for e-voting in the UK, and more recently on our campaign to try to stop the three strikes legislation, which the United Kingdom is trying to introduce for people who infringe copyright online, and against privacy invading technologies like Form, who wanted to produce sort of behavioral advertising based on ISP traffic, which wouldn't have allowed, would not have asked consent of all users, only those on the ISP's networks. So, essentially, rather like the EFF, we campaign for people's rights online and in more broadly in the digital age. Unlike EFF, we're less legalistic. We do less work in the courts, and we basically don't work in the courts. We work directly with government. So it's rather different tactics, but very similar objectives.
That's interesting because that is chiefly what EFF does, is litigate. I'd file a Freedom of Information Act and so forth. Why did you, when you founded Open Rights, decide not to take that route?
Well, I think perhaps as a smaller country, the United Kingdom, it feels perhaps a little bit easier to access sort of government processes, perhaps because the legal system is less used in that sort of way in the UK as well. I mean, I think a lot of essentially rights matters get settled in the States through litigation, and that really isn't far less the case in the UK. It's far more about essentially legislative arguments, I think.
We seem to have lost Danny. I'm going to call him back and see if we can get him on. But it might just be the three of us if we can't get him. Of course, it's ironic because Danny is about 20 miles away, and you're all the way in the UK. But you know, that is one of the issues that comes up a lot. Is what the and in fact, I know this is a really challenging issue in the States. This issue of net neutrality, the issue of whether you know, the open internet can be preserved. And I know the EFF has struggled a little bit with this, Jim, because. You know, on the one hand, it feels like you need the government's help to keep big telecoms from and ISPs from gating the internet. And the other hand, it's kind of not what the EFF wants, is government intervention. Does Open Rights talk about net neutrality at all?
We do a bit, and certainly there's a developing debate in Europe now, because we've recently had something called the telecoms package pass through Europe, which essentially allows the telecoms operators to do what they like with internet traffic. And there's an obvious worry that when you look at the number of these telecoms operators who are actually also content providers and are now trying to sell content directly to their internet users, that there is an obvious conflict of interest there, which could very quickly lead to the sort of problems that have been flagged up by campaigners in the United States. And at the same time, these same companies who are getting conflict of interest have argued very, very strongly for the ability to discriminate on behalf of, you know, the sort of traffic, various sorts of traffic within the telecoms package. So they've, on the one hand, gained the powers, and on the other hand, they have the conflict of interest. And it's really quite a worrying situation, and it certainly does need... I think in European countries, it's a bit more comfortable to talk about government regulation, and it's likely to need to have some sort of intervention. Obviously, government intervention on the net does, as EFS says, you know, it generally does tend to lead to quite bad places, and it isn't an ideal solution. But somewhere along the line, somebody's got to look at what these companies are doing, and it probably needs to be something a bit quicker than competition law. The argument's been made that competition law will allow people to work out what the problems are and intervene. But of course, those sort of disputes take absolutely years to settle. And by the time they are settled, the damage has been done. You look at what Microsoft did over the browser wars and bundling software. The European Union intervened and tried to rectify that situation through competition law, but in effect the damage was done, and it's never really been able to rectify that at all. All it's been able to do is impose fines, and that really isn't an answer.
So you listed a lot of battles that you're fighting at the same time. Is the thing that's in common with all those battles that the opposing team, whatever that is has some intellectual property rights, and they're trying to use the legal system to enforce that?
I mean, intellectual property rights are one big part of these arguments. I don't think that would be the absolute sort of common factor. I think the common factor is that there are commercial interests. Sometimes they're... there are different commercial interests arguing against each other in these debates. But I think what the common factor is, we're living in an information age. We've got to think about how that information is used to the best ability for the public good and the public interest. And it's only groups like Open Rights and the EFF who are bringing that public interest into the debate. Without citizen-based groups like us, and there are plenty of other examples in the States as well, I could think of half a dozen, I'm sure.
There's CDT, there's Epic, there's quite a few, yeah.
Yeah, and these are the people who are actually trying to say, let's think about what's good for the public rather than just leave this for between commercial interests to argue it out, because that way the actual, you know, how we use information, how we get the benefits out of the digital age, that then is not reflective of the public good if those groups are not in that debate. I think the other thing we have to think about is, you know, there are obviously the consequences to use of data, which are very good and very potentially also very bad. But sort of underlying this is the fact that data is easier to collect, it's easier to store, it's easier to process. And when that's information, if you like, that's not personal, that's about us learning and doing things, then in general, getting that information more and more widely used is of huge benefit. But when it's personal information, then and there's a loss of control for individuals, then that can have rather more negative impacts. But it's the same underlying sort of factor of technological change and what that brings in the digital age, which is driving these debates.
We're going to. I'm keeping to try to call Danny. I would like to get him in, and we will get him in when we get a good connection with him. But I guess what I would have asked him, and I'll ask you instead, Jim, is has EFF been helpful in starting Open Rights Group?
Yeah, and Danny was one of the people who was really involved in helping the Open Rights Group get going, and he's been on the board for, I think, since more or less the beginning. So, yeah, I mean, I think the EFF was very, very helpful and, you know, obviously also just provided a really good inspirational model for the Open Rights Group to think about the range of issues that needed to be dealt with, and the fact that we could mobilize people around the idea that we have digital rights, that this is something we can identify and talk about and actually need to talk about, because no one else is going to do it. It has to be citizens who do that.
Now, I'm a big free market believer, and I would like to think that the free market would have sorted all these issues out. Now, is it the problem that this is really the antithesis of the free market, or is it the free market's being perverted by large organizations that have that kind of influence that's really messing the situation up?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there are two things here. Firstly, obviously free markets, as you say, can be distorted by corporate interests, and that, you know, actually a lot of corporations would prefer to have monopolies and no competition at all, you often feel.
Of course, yeah.
That's an easy life, isn't it, if you can get it? Uh-huh. But the other fact, if you can get that sort of monopoly, then it becomes an easy life. But the other factor, I think, is that intellectual property is very difficult to base, you know, it's very difficult to base competition on pure intellectual property, because intellectual property often is actually a monopoly. So if you think about music or film, if somebody wants to listen to a particular sort of music, unless there are sort of wider licensing changes, then there's only one person who has that set of pieces of music that you can go to. So there are some things about intellectual property which are not necessarily completely conducive to getting free markets to operate well, which is why I think in the States you see various sorts of solutions around radio, cable TV, and other sorts of copyright, which force licensing to open the market up so you can have greater competition. And that is what we haven't seen, for instance, with music online, that there hasn't been a sort of opening up of the licensing to allow a free market to properly function.
We've got Danny on the phone now.
Hey.
Well, there's always a way. Where there's a will, there's a way. Danny, sorry about the trouble with
this. It's
all
right. We have this problem with the NSA all the time.
Yeah, they could be tapping you. Who knows? Danny, I often get a sense when I read about this stuff that it really is U.S.-based content companies that are, you know, promulgating things like the DMCA and ACTA. And it really it's stuff that we're spreading.
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I've as the accent indicates, I've sort of worked on both sides of the Atlantic, and I think that probably used to be the case, and that meant that a lot of very dangerous early precedents were set with things like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is, you know, relatively early in this big fight. But I was reading a really great article by the guy who is I'm blanking on the company's name, but I think it's Big Champagne, who do the sit between the music industry and the entertainment industries in general and P2P networks. They actually monitor P2P networks to find out what's popular and give that research back to the entertainment industries. And the CEO of that company has a very interesting take on this, which he says, well, actually, you know, in many ways, the American companies have sort of gone through their trauma now, at least in the music industry. They're beginning to work out ways of changing their business model. Because I think a lot of this has always been about denial, right? Rather than maliciously trying to destroy the internet. It's sort of a misunderstanding that the internet just isn't going to go away or do things the way you want to. And I think that they've kind of come to the acceptance point in the U.S. Whereas that's not necessarily the case in Europe and other countries. There's still a struggle to work out exactly how to deal with this and how we can regulate it. And the trouble is with things like ACTA is that provides a perfect opportunity for the worst of American law to be copied over and new absolutely terrible ideas to be re-imported in. Right? So like three strikes. Now three strikes. Do you guys know what three strikes is?
Why don't you explain it?
Why don't I? Yeah. So three strikes is this insane idea, right? That because prosecuting people for file sharing takes too long and costs too much to the music industry, they'll cut out the middleman, which is to say the judge.
The courts.
Right, the courts.
The rule of law. We don't need that.
Those intermediaries in the internet age.
Hate
and
that stuff.
After three accusations, just accusations, you'll not only be thrown off your internet connection, like being kicked from an IRC channel, you'll actually be banned in France, which is the only country that's really sort of rolled this out for real. There's a sort of national blacklist of people that won't be allowed on the internet.
Didn't they soften it though a little bit in France? I mean,
well, so the big I don't like to say that they softened it, because what happened is the Constitutional Court, which is sort of like the Supreme Court, but it gets a first stab at telling lawmakers
first not
crazy.
Last. Yeah.
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 Sort of when you're mad, like you've got to have a judge in this process somewhere. And they went back, and what they really put in was sort of a smear of judicial respectability. Basically, I think you can appeal if you're thrown off the net, and I think a judge sort of rubber stamps it effectively. But at the same time, like, you know, we don't streamline any other serious crime because, you know, we're worried about it. It's not like
we treat this more heinously than murder, terrorism.
Exactly.
This is the worst thing you can do. And by the way, banning somebody from the internet is draconian. It is heinous.
Right. So, and this is one of those things where it's very interesting how it's sort of playing out in Europe, is that this is prompted a very big reaction, not just in terms of, you know, judicial due process, but as I'm sure Jim would say, like a lot of people in Europe say, well, look, it's getting to the point where internet access is a human right in itself. Now, I think that's a very European take on rights and the internet, but I do think that, you know, one of the consequences of this, if we're hearing rumors, and they're just rumors at this point, that a three strikes bill will be introduced some point soon in the United States, and you know, in the U.S., I think the challenges are going to be very much about due process and so forth. But the problem here is that what you might get is simply a private agreement by ISPs to do this kind of thing, because, you know, they've had enough of being hassled by the music and entertainment industries, and they just want a quiet life.
Mm. Can we talk about ACTA? Because ACTA is really the mechanism by which these groups are trying to make this not just law in many countries, but global law, is it
right,
not?
Right.
And it's being done in secret, which is something I find anathema.
Well, not only in secret, which is kind of par for the course for, like, you know, these quiet sort of, if this was what it claims to be, which is basically an agreement to just, you know, make sure that border guards have enough powers to check on counterfeit products and stop fake Rolexes from entering the country, whatever, then this sort of secret discussion would be somewhat normal, right? The problem with this is that it's almost deliberately engineered to be secretive to exclude the people who would be who are most impacted
us.
By this, right? So yes. And this also, as Jim said, this often happens with copyright because historically copyright has always been a deal between big companies. You know, right. In the old days, TwitTV would be owned by some big broadcasting network. It would be negotiating with another network, and everything about copyright is designed so publishers and distributors can make big deals, sign the contract, and then that's the end of the problem, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the problem is now is that, you know, everything you and I do is copyrighted and affected by these laws, even if we're just chatting to our gran, right, on the net. If I'm emailing to my friend or, forwarding a funny video around, all of that is impacted by these laws that are really designed as sort of industrial laws. It's like we're supposed to follow some sort of shipping regulation or something like that. And Actor is a classic example of that problem, right? Because usually copyright laws like this are negotiated in a not really much better forum like the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO.
Now, another group that's a stalking horse for the big content.
Right, right. But the funny thing is about 10 years ago, close to 10 years ago, you know, we realized that this was going on at WIPO, that WIPO was in fact the forum by which the DMCA effectively got passed in the United States. When the DMCA's provisions were first proposed, lawmakers went, as the French Constitutional Court did, are you on crack? And the law moved away into another forum. We call this policy laundering, right? Where you can't get it through a normal democratic process. So you go to somewhere where you're not going to be bothered by annoying things like people calling in saying this is crazy. So WIPO was traditionally the place you do that. But the thing is that the EFF and organizations like ORG in lots of different countries can go to WIPO because it's ostensibly, you know, a public process. And also countries like Brazil, who do really well out of free software, who are in a position of being a developing country that understands the benefits of having a more sort of liberal copyright regime, are there too, so they can complain. And consequently, what's happened is that WIPO is actually now an interesting place, relatively speaking, right? In Geneva, they talk about things like a development agenda, which is all about like making open source licenses more readily understandable all across the world, flattening out the sort of exceptions, limitations, and fair use so that everyone knows what page they're on. So there's all this really interesting discussion going on in WIPO, and consequently, when you want to pass something really somewhat bad, they've had to go off and do it in secret. And that's what ACTA is. The people in ACTA basically say, well, look, WIPO's log-jammed now, so let's go off into our own little space and discuss this.
Well, it's hard not to go, yes, Smithers, let's solve this between us, man to man.
From their secret lair.
The thing with ACTA, though, is that, you know, I've been sitting in, it's like Kremlinology, I swear to you. I have to sit there and look at leaked documents on WikiLeaks to find out what's going on. And, you know, a lot of people, us included, have, like, specced out what the worst thing could be. And a lot of other people have gone, well, you know, maybe it's not as bad as that. And the tragedy is that we simply don't know because no one outside a few lobbyists gets to see what's in that piece of paper. And we know that those lobbyists are pushing for absolutely the worst things possible.
Of course.
They're going for all the crazy ideas that they've tried to pass for years. And I don't know whether that, maybe there's great diplomats there who sit there going, oh, no, this looks terrible. We can't have this. Or maybe, like in the South Korean free trade agreement, which was all secret. As soon as it came out, there were riots in South Korea over it, not over the internet provisions, but the internet provisions. If you read them, if I sent you some of the stuff in the South Korean internet provisions, you would go, how did this get passed?
Yeah.
There's a bit in one of the side letters which says, South Korea agrees to, I can't remember the exact wording because I'm not a lawyer, but basically stamp out web hard services. And I'm sitting there going, what are web hard services? That sounds kind of awesome. And I looked them up and I spent some time chatting to South Koreans and they said, well, web hard services are hard drives online. They're like web dev. Right. Basically, if you're living in a country like South Korea, which has incredibly fast bandwidth, then the obvious thing to do is to set up a nice sort of API and interface where you can save files onto a storage in the cloud.
Like EC2.
Exactly. Like EC2 or Dropbox or something like that.
They want to ban that?
In the side letter, Korea commits to trying to, stop these things because they're obviously dens of piracy.
Of course. That's what we use Dropbox for. What else could we possibly be using it for?
Yeah. And since then, since the FTA, that free trade agreement has gone through, South Korea has gone from being like the future of the internet to being this horrible dystopia where I heard reports that Google basically doesn't let people upload music to their blogging service in South Korea for fear of liability. They've stopped people uploading to YouTube because there's an anti-anonymity law. That got passed, and Google just basically went, we don't want to be in the position where we're constantly getting orders to hand over the private information of our users in South Korea, so forget
it. This is really important, though, because there's a huge consequence to a nation that adopts this treaty in terms of its ability to participate in the open internet.
Well, I think there's always two sides to this, right? There's the people... There's sort of what the law says, and you suddenly go, oh, God, this is like an awful law with huge consequences. And then when you're trying to talk about this, a lot of people go, well, I'm just going to ignore the law.
Right.
It's like the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA. Those are criminal, both senses of that term, right? If you copy a DVD onto your hard drive, then you're actually being a criminal. You can be criminally prosecuted. If you tell someone how to do that, you're a criminal. Mm-hmm. You can be imprisoned by the police, right? Now, everybody says, well, they're never going to catch me, right? I'm just going to do it anyway. Yeah. And so these laws are both ridiculous and are never going to affect me.
But this is what I like about Larry Lessig. He's always said, look, don't violate the law. Change the law.
Right,
it is a cop-out to say, oh, well, it's a bad law. I'm just going to pirate.
And the tragedy is what it means is that the only people who get to use computers in the most useful way are techies like us. Right, I know how to play a DVD on my Linux machine.
Right.
I can't tell you it because it's criminal for me to tell you how to do it. But techies can work that kind of thing out. But there's never going to be a commercial business that offers the chance for us to do things that we can legally do through our fair use rights with content that require us to undo DRM, right? There's never going to be a legal business that allows you to play iTunes downloaded music with DRM, or iTunes movies now, because Steve Jobs, bless his heart, has pushed for no DRM. But, play your iTunes movie, which you have paid for, on anything other than a DRM setup iPhone or iPod.
Jim, what's the status in the UK of the three strikes? Is it a possibility there?
It's a very strong possibility right at this moment. We've got a site, 3strikes.openrights.org, where we're asking people to write to Peter Mandelson, who's the business secretary, to ask him to withdraw the plans he's pushing right now to have people struck off the internet for a period of time. He's saying, not to say exactly how long, for alleged copyright violations. There's talk about potential appeals. It's the same sort of situation as France, where there's a sort of veneer of legal process being placed upon this process. But what we all know, of course, is that the evidence is not good, and repeatedly, when people have been taken to court in other countries and the evidence has been examined, it just doesn't stack up, because you're talking about at best identifying an IP address and knowing that somebody behind that IP address on any one of any number of computers behind that IP address may have been downloading or uploading content which may or may not have been infringing in a particular circumstance. So we've been asking people to write to Peter Mandelson, and if there's people here in the UK listening tonight, then they should go and do that as well. You know, let these people know that they're extremely wrong. And you know, you've got several hundred people there in a day and a half who've done exactly that. We're also asking people.
You know, it seems so obvious, though, to us that are technology people, that this is something that, it just doesn't make any sense from a technology point of view. Are the people who are passing these laws, are they just uneducated about technology issues, or are the motivations so strong on the other side that really, no matter how well educated they were in the technology, it wouldn't make any difference?
There's both of those operating, I think. The whole 3 strikes plan was debated at some length under what was called Digital Britain. And they were trying to work out how they could, quote, deal, unquote, with piracy, unquote. So they worked out that there was a problem with licensing music online, and they needed to do something about that. They've never quite worked out or said exactly what they're going to do about that. And they also sort of decided that they wanted to sort of educate consumers and tell them that it was wrong, and they would do this by letter writing. And it appears that writing letters to people telling them that they shouldn't be infringing copyright does work. But the way it works, of course, isn't to gain anyone an income. It sort of frightens people off doing what they're currently doing and frightens people away from using the technology to perhaps its greatest effects. But that doesn't earn anyone any money. It potentially just pushes them away, and I guess it persuades a number of people to encrypt and anonymize themselves. And if you look at the sort of area, you know, places like Japan, where 3 strikes has happened sort of through the back door with ISPs, this is what happens. People go for anonymous peer-to-peer technologies, and they just hide themselves better. So that's obviously one of the likely consequences. But earning money for musicians, you know, that doesn't seem to be very where nobody really understands how this is going to do that. Nobody can seriously suggest that it will.
So there was a great report when Peter Mandelson, who all of his advisors basically said 3 strikes is a dumb idea, and he went out for he visited Corfu and had a nice meal with the entertainment industry and came back and said, we're going to do it anyway. And when he announced this, there was a sort of leak in one of the UK papers from MI5. So, which you will know from the James Bond movie,
yeah,
right?
It's a secret service.
And MI5 basically said, look, don't do this, because it's going to increase the amount of anonymous encrypted traffic online. Now, you know, of course, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, but but as Jim's described, here's what happens, right? They do 3 strikes. It doesn't work. We all know it's not going to work, right? The it's not like people are going to go, oh, I guess people are writing letters and throwing my friends off the internet. I will go out and spend much more money buying CDs, right? The music industry is still going to have problems, right? Yeah. Because the business has changed, right? And again, right? We see this in the U.S., right? You know what? In music industry discussions, what they complain about the most is the internet is bad. But you know what's also really bad? people burning music onto CDs and doing
they hate
CDs,
that.
Yep, right?
Yep.
So you know, it's not as if this technology is going to go away. Like, if they block everything on the internet, what are we going to do? We're going to get when I say we, they, right? People are going to get, a terabyte drive, take it to their dorm,
right?
And just transfer, go, hey, I've got all the music from the 1950s onwards to 1970. You have 1970 to 1990. Let's sync our hard drives, right? So this is just kind of carry on. And what happens when it carry on is the music industry goes back to the well and says, hey, we're still losing money. Can you ban encrypted communications, right? Can you ban anonymous?
Just ban humans because they're just bad.
Right.
Ban the internet because it's great at copying. I mean, we've got these machines that are great at copying and great at distributing. You know, you have to change copyright to reflect that. You have to find licensing mechanisms or whatever it takes to make that work. Copyright is a fundamental problem with copyright is it is about copy restriction. And unless you get over that, unless you find a way of making copyright reflect payment and be a payment mechanism and a way of remunerating people rather than simply a restriction on copying, we're not going to get anywhere. But actually, that shouldn't be very hard to do. I think as Danny is saying, as everyone's been saying, part of the problem is that politicians don't understand. They're very ill-advised. That's a really difficult one. That's a very, very tough nut to crack. But again, I think the answer is, people basically getting on the streets and showing them that it's wrong. You know, get out there and protest. You know, actually send those letters, but also go meet your MPs. Do whatever it takes.
So there is a glimmer of hope in that. A, we can educate the people that are making the laws when they don't have that education. But B, I think we still, and I think that you're addressing this already, that we also need to talk about the will of the people that. It's not just big industry that gets to help decide these laws. There is the will of the people to want to share and distribute and be a small band that wants to send their stuff over the net. We've got to cover both axes of that. There is education, but there's also will of the people to be known. Is that what you're saying?
I think that the really useful thing here is that it sounds kind of fatalistic, but it really isn't, is that time is on our side, right? The music industry is so much easier to deal with now because the people who saw the horizon for stuff like the internet taking over go outside like when they were going to retire have all gone, right? They're all slowly going. The sort of Jack Valenti generation is going. And the young people have joined the music industry, knowing it was a music industry in trouble, having grown up probably sharing music online themselves for the last 10 years, and really love music and want to fix it. And so, and that's, you see that in everything, right? There are a lot of IP lawyers, intellectual property lawyers now, who grew up using technology, understand, you know, free software licenses, things like this, and so can apply that to the IP law, which would never used to be the case. And very slowly, absolutely, desperately slowly, we're getting politicians that get this too. And I really think a lot of the work that's involved now is just holding back these dumb ideas, right? Stopping politicians from passing laws now, because in 5-10 years' time, this won't be a problem. These ideas will be as laughed at in parliaments and Congress than as they are, you know, in IRC channels.
We know, Danny, that people in the U.S. can go to EFF.org/action and read about ACTA and ACT. Mm-hmm. We know that people in the U.K. can go to 3strikes.openrightsgroup.org. But we have listeners all over the world, and this is an issue for every single country.
Right.
Is there one place people could go, or is each country you have to find your EFF or your org equivalent?
Well, it's really good to find your local EFF.
Yeah, org support
equivalent.
That.
That's really good. Yeah. I'm actually, it's funny you should ask, but I've promised to launch this or eat my hat at the EFF offices. I'm just working on a thing. It's not up yet, so when you go there, you'll just find like a little beta-only login and password thing. But in the next week or so, I'm going to launch a thing called copyrightwatch.org, copyright-watch.org. Mm. And what we've done is, I've worked with librarians, and we're going to collect together all of the laws in every single country, and I'm finding out, I've just been talking to somebody in Mongolia to find somebody who knows about copyright law in Mongolia.
Wow.
I was in like Kazakhstan a few weeks ago talking to people there. And really what this is to stop is what I talked about before, policy laundering, which is where people who really want overly strong copyright try to pass it in each country individually, because they think, because if three strikes passes in the UK, I can guarantee that the moment that happens, someone will come to the United States Congress and say, well, UK and France are doing it, why don't we?
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happened with the DMCA. It's exactly what happened with copyright extension. Me and Jim fought really hard to stop copyright extension in Europe, but the reason why it was hard to argue against was because people went, well, they do it in the U.S. And they only did it in the U.S. because they copied the Europe.
Well, it's funny because I'm sure it came from the U.S. originally. I mean, WIPO has been taken over by big content, and it's mostly U.S.
Like I say, you know, if you want really strong copyright, it doesn't matter where you are. Like, people are fight strong copyright in Nigeria. They fight in all kinds of places, because it's not about individual countries. It's about two different ways of thinking about how you make money.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you see how free software spread like across the world, right? And, you know, I'm not going to say that free software is like an American invention. If Richard Stallman had been in India, right, it would have spread as quickly.
Right.
I think. And,
absolutely right. That's a very chauvinistic thing to say. I'm blaming our movie industry, however, for some of this.
I think sometimes
the record industry.
People. I think the best one of the ways you can
our anti-piracy efforts are the best in the world. USA number one.
I think Mandelson will try and test you on that.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good run at it. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Jeez. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't get to form and we didn't get to online surveillance. UK has more cameras per square foot than any country in the world, I understand. And we form, which is was a UK invention, which has been they tried to export to the US. Unfortunately, we fought them back. But there are a lot of attacks on our rights right now. And I think one of the problems. I was at an EFF salon last week in San Francisco.
Oh,
and John Perry Barlow called it. Brad was there, and it was a really interesting event. But one of the things that's difficult, I think, for EFF, for org, for all of these groups, is these are fairly technical issues.
Right.
And the general populace isn't, you know, really yet, they're worried about other issues, and they're not yet really, this isn't on their radar. So I think it's us geeks, the people who watch this network, people who listen to you, Randall, who have to be the Paul Reveres of this.
Indeed.
To use a U.S. metaphor.
Yeah, I was going to say, we don't really see Paul Revere.
Yeah. The British aren't coming. No, it's the...
that rat.
bad simile.
It is the geeks, the technologists who have to lead.
Yes.
It is true, but it isn't completely true that the public doesn't understand these issues or doesn't engage with them. There was huge public outcry when people realized that the government was going to try to monitor all of their Facebook messages and all the rest of it. People were genuinely outraged, and there were a lot of people who wanted to get involved in stopping that. So I think when people actually realize that this is going to affect them, then they do get very, very angry, and they do want to do something about it. But obviously it needs technologists to actually translate this and to make sure that these things are being monitored as much as anything, that we know what the government and what government departments are really planning and what people in ACTA are negotiating. You know, it is right. It is people who understand what technology offers, both in its greatest and most effective and forward-looking ways, and in the ways where it can be used for bad ends as well.
people ask
I think also because more people are becoming online, more people are actually sharing technology now. I mean, it's becoming prevalent when everybody can have a smartphone and send email and send videos and pictures back and forth. You start to get a sense that, you know, when government is monitoring email was only for the few people who actually were online, most people couldn't really relate to that. But now that everybody, I mean, you know, everybody I know sends email back and forth on their smartphone. So they're paying attention to this stuff now. So we actually have the majority now of people starting to pay attention.
Right. I'd spent years explaining the problems with DRM, right? And the point where people got it was the point when people were ripping CDs to put on their iPod. Right, and as soon as that, they just went, "Oh yeah, I totally get it. What, I won't be able to copy my music and create a digital music collection? That's outrageous!" And if there are two things that I tell geeks to do, right, one is build the tools so that everyone can use this and understand this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that makes people understand these issues is when they actually use them in their daily life. Mm-hmm. And the second one, which is far more specific, right, is when you're producing an open piece of open source software, don't make it default to logging.
Right? Keep you no know? Track. Leave no traces.
Well, just you know, not even as much as that. Just don't make the defaults log everything, because it's really tempting to ship something in debug mode, right?
Right, right.
Mm. And, you know, it drives me crazy how many fewer problems we'd have about subpoenas and getting hold of people's information if Apache had defaulted to not logging IP addresses. I think it's an easy thing for people to do. And I know there are reasons for logging, but logging should be for debugging. It shouldn't be for just, like, default data collection.
And part of it is that you realize that we came from an era where none of this made any difference. Right. And now we're being thrust as technologists into the mainstream, where people that are with different sets of priorities are definitely looking at the stuff that we were doing over the last 20 years.
I remember Brian Berlendorf, like, sitting there with Apache running under his desk, right? And his desktop machine was running hotwired, right? He was just running it, the website from his machine.
Right.
And, you know, you don't sit there going, oh, what will happen when a million people use my software? But just spend 5 minutes just before you upload something to Fresh Meat and go, okay, what would be the impacts to privacy and how people use this stuff and civil liberties if a billion people used my software?
Well, it sounds like most of the project leaders for open source software ought to read a lot of the material that's on the EFF site and on the Open Rights Group sites then, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course, but, you know, followers on Twitter or whatever, you know, just keep an eye on this, because I think one of the things that is hard is that, you know, we can talk about ACTA right now because I could point to something going on in Korea and say, look, everyone pay attention, this is happening right now. But actually, ACTA's been happening for 2 years, and most of the time I've been really boring about it, right? Because it's hard to say, oh, there's this secret thing that might be happening and, you know, it could really be bad in 2 years' time. But geeks are first adopters, if nothing else. And if we want them to be the front defense against this stuff, you have to keep an eye on it before it hits the headlines.
Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful also not to be sensationalist, too. So I know that it's hard to actually be sensationalist when a lot of this stuff really is that bad.
You don't want to
paint it too broad.
The risks of crying wolf are really hard. And also because, you know, one of the real challenges on the internet is you can cry wolf really quietly, and then suddenly everybody picks it up and retweets it, and suddenly it's the world's worst thing, and you haven't said anything that extreme. It's just that people suddenly realize what the risk is, and then it's a game of Chinese whispers. So,
yeah, we have the trouble that people think that we're wearing tinfoil hats and watching for the black helicopters, when really we're not. And we're being reasonable about this stuff.
Right, right. You know, sometimes, you know, people think that this stuff is, like I say, it's either not going to affect them or it's raving tin hat lunacy stuff. And what I'm trying to say is, you know, it's actually kind of a middle ground.
Be reasonable in your challenge, yes.
Right. You draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, when you see something like intercept modernization plans in the UK, where the government thinks that it can just use deep packet inspection to, you know, reassemble everybody's Hotmail traffic and everybody's Facebook pages and then extract who they're emailing or who they're messaging on all those sites. And that they can do that not just for the services of today, but every single service that emerges over the next 5 or 10 years. And that that's a reasonable sort of thing to do. Well, you've got to say, maybe it's not the people with the tinfoil hats who are a little bit off their rockers.
Hey, guys, you know, it's been really good. I think we could probably go another hour with this conversation. In fact, actually, I think I'm going to have you guys back on in a couple of months, yeah, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, it's such an important
talk about.
Such yeah. a great set of stories. We just barely scratched the surface. One last statement from each of you. Jim, you want to go?
Yeah, if you are interested, you know, if you're interested in technology, if you want, if you're thinking actively about the consequences of it, then you should take that action further. I think you should get involved in campaigns like Open Rights Group and EFF, and you should also think about supporting us financially, because that's how we can be consistent about these things and actually make a difference. So join in the campaigns, and if you can, put your hand in your pocket and join up.
Open Rights Group was started by a bunch of geeks in, you know, basically like a bar camp, where we all said, why don't we just pledge to put a fiver a month and start an organization? And that's mm-hmm. all it took. 1,000 people doing that was enough to employ an executive director like Jim and set something up. And that's all you have to do. Like, you can forget about it after that. And, you know, same is true for the EFF, but same is true in any country, I think. If you can get 1,000 like-minded people who are willing to spend $10 a month, you can have somebody full-time working on this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for fighting the good fight. I really appreciate you taking your time out of the day today.
Hey, no problem. It's great fun.
Thanks,
thank
Danny.
You.
Take care. Thank you, Jim. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
So timely that you got them on. I was just at this EFF thing last week.
Yeah.
And learning about ACTA and all of these other, you know, the NSA wiretaps. We talk about some of this on Security Now form. We talked about on Security Now, which was reprehensible. Mm-hmm. And so I'm so glad you got them on. I think this is something that, you know, it's not strictly speaking open source software, but if you want a free and open internet, which is a prerequisite for open source software, you've got to stand up and be counted on these issues.
Especially as alpha adopters that are really, can see the whole issues from the top to the bottom. I mean, that's really important because, you know, we're the ones that can finally explain it to our legislators and to our you know, our legal system. I mean, I know more of that better than anybody else, actually, because of my personal involvement. So, and again, I wish we had more time, but, you know, like, for those that are watching in real time, I'm actually running off immediately after I finish taping the show.
We're going to let you go in 30 seconds.
I'm going to speak
just
really
quickly
fast.
Wrap up this show, and then we'll get you out of here, because I know you're going to be at Ignite. When's Ignite coming
Portland.
Up?
IgnitePortland.com, which is next Thursday. It's free. If you're in the Portland area, please come. And tomorrow night, I'm doing exactly the same talk, which is karaoke for fun and profit. Tomorrow night, if you're watching the live show, IgniteSalem.com. So we're down in Salem, about an hour south of Portland.
Yeah,
so
you can go to all the Ignites one by one and do this talk.
Exactly. There was Ignite Corvallis last week that they actually thought I was going to. And I said, no, I'm not going to be there, but that's okay. So I'm going to be having a fun time doing both of those. So if you're in town, please do that. Just a quick word on our upcoming guests. We have a lot of really great guests coming up real soon. Next week, we have, in fact, a whole panel of people speaking about BioPearl. We, of course, have Marc Pelletier, who does the Futures in Biotech for Twit Network. He's going to be helping us interview Jason Stolich and Chris Fields, who are experts in how Pearl is being used to help all things like the Human Genome Project and a bunch of other areas. This will be really fun. This is going to be a great interview for that. Immediately on the short list, we also have Wolfgang Meyer on the Exist database, an XML-based hierarchical database. And Chris DeBona, of course, is coming back to do our show number 100 to talk about all the ways that things have happened over the last few years since he helped start this show back at the beginning. Matthew Gates is talking about Stellarium, which is a planetarium program to show where stars are in the sky. A lot of other people on the short list. If you want to see the list, it's at twit.tv/floss. You can also find contact information there for me to come find out how to suggest other people for the show. So go check that out and see if they're on the list.
All right. Run, young Padawan learner. You have karaoke to sing. And we'll see you all. Don't forget, everybody, EFF.org and, of course, openrightsgroup.org. And make your voice heard. This is so important. We will see you next time on Floss Weekly.